You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
You can find the answer to almost anything by searching online. And with mobile technology, you don't even need to be at your desk. What does that mean for what we should teach in schools? Do children need facts, or do they need to know how to find facts? That emphasis on skills feeds into what has been a popular theory in education, that anything a child learns for themselves through discovery is more valuable than being told it by a teacher. But my guest, my educator today, thinks a generation of children has been let down by that approach and left with glaring gaps in their knowledge because of what schools are not teaching them. Born in London's East End, Daisy Christodoulou is a teacher and writer. She thinks that teaching through discovery is a myth that may please the school's inspector Ofsted, but does little for the child. When she said as much in a book recently, it prompted an outcry from teachers and educationalists. Some saying, at last here was someone speaking the truth, and others saying she couldn't be more wrong. Daisy Christodoulou, welcome to The Educators. What is it that schools are getting so wrong with the way that they teach?
It's this idea that in the modern world, facts are less necessary than before because we can look them up on Google, that education shouldn't focus on learning facts or on learning knowledge, that the model of education shouldn't be about the teacher telling people things. I think there's this idea as well that if pupils discover things for themselves, that that's the best way to learn. So I think all these ideas are very prominent across the education system.
I mean, you found it because when you were a teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing I look at most in my book to give evidence that these ideas really are dominant, I look at a number of sources. I suppose one of the ones that's been argued over the most is I look at the evidence from Ofsted subject reports. So the school's inspector at Ofsted, as well as their school inspections, every couple of years they publish reports into individual subjects. I analysed the most recent 9 of those and looked at the kind of lessons they were describing, the kind of lessons they were saying were very good practice. I analysed in total 228 lessons, and I found that in nearly all of them, the kind of methods I just spoke about were being praised, and methods where the teacher was transmitting knowledge or the teacher was teaching even were either just not mentioned at all, or in the very few occasions they were mentioned were explicitly criticised as bad practice.
Well, give us an example from your own experience of when you were a teacher and you were thinking, I know I'm meant to be doing it this way, at least I'm told I'm meant to be doing this way, but it doesn't feel the best way to teach a child.
Well, there was just, I suppose, again and again, you'd see pupils writing essays and they'd be analysing texts, and I'd feel that they were lacking the basic knowledge that would help them to write those essays. So, for example, they'd have a fairly shaky grasp of grammatical concepts and a shaky grasp of sentence structure, but there was really sort of no time in the curriculum, and it was frowned upon if you spent a lot of time teaching those aspects of grammar in detail. You know, that'll be one example from my experience as an English teacher. And certainly, you know, I think the way grammar has been taught and the way that it's seemed to be taught in those Ofsted lessons where it is mentioned, it's mentioned very much as sort of bit parts of lessons, if it's mentioned at all. You won't see grammar being taught explicitly and lessons being given over to it.
So they're struggling with everything beyond that because they don't have the basics.
That would be one of my analyses, that the shaky grasp of the fundamentals and a shaky grasp of those building blocks of knowledge.
But wouldn't that a teacher, if you notice the child is getting it wrong, you try to fill in that gap as you go along?
Absolutely would. And I think, you know, when we talk about the education system, I think there are many good teachers, and certainly I was very lucky to work with some of them, who are struggling to do this. But it's still hard to do it when a system is set up that it's making it harder. So, for example, if you know that Ofsted are going to come in and inspect you, that's not the kind of lesson they want to see, that's not going to help.
What does Ofsted want to see?
Well, as I say, if you look at the publications that I analyse, if you look at, you know, other things they've published, you say, you know, it would be easy to just, you could, if your pupils are struggling with something, you can intervene and teach them it. But often what pupils need is frequent practice to sort of go over things and repeat things. And that is also frowned upon very much as well. You know, it gets a pejorative name of drill and kill. And actually frequent practice is really necessary for higher order skill.
Because they're being encouraged instead, what, to discuss things in class, to have group discussions where the child is far more active and not listening to the teacher?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the phrases you'll hear a lot is the teacher should be a guide on the side, not a sage on the stage. So there's very much the idea that it's a good idea for lessons to be led by students, for them to be taking the lead, and for the teacher, if you like, to just facilitate that. And again, that's something where the evidence on this is quite shaky. You know, the method of teaching called direct instruction has had phenomenal results all over the world. And it's a method which involves the teacher standing at the front, if you like, and teaching. in all the research that's been done on that, it's proved to be a highly, highly effective method of teaching.
So you're saying we should what? Go back to what you think was a golden age when there were more facts?
I don't think there was ever a golden age. I think if you look back to the 1950s, I think there were plenty of things wrong then with our education system.
But in terms of the amount of facts they were trying to get across, are you saying, look, we need to get back to that quantity of facts in our learning? Or are you saying, actually, we need to push far more facts on children?
I think if you look at the modern evidence, and this is evidence which actually wasn't around in the 1950s, and I'm talking about the evidence here from cognitive psychology, and if you look at that research, what you'll find is a bedrock of facts in long-term memory, a schema, that's what the term is in the literature, a schema of facts that form a sort of, if you like, a web of understanding. That is absolutely fundamental for learning.
And are we talking about more facts than children have ever learned?
That's an odd question. I mean, I must say, I've not got longitudinal data on the number of facts children have learned over centuries or decades. I think what we need to do as educators is to look at the higher order skill we want to develop and to look at the fundamental facts in that subject, which would allow you to achieve that higher order skill. Mm. And so that's what I'd like to see. And the man who's written about this extensively is Herbert Simon, who's a great sort of 20th century polymath. He won the Nobel Prize for his work, actually, on decision-making. But he did a lot of work on expertise in a number of different areas. And one of the things he constantly repeats is that in order to achieve expertise, you need a considerable body of knowledge and a lot of practice at retrieving that knowledge in a lot of different contexts.
OK. Well, a lot of people would say you're arguing for something that in many schools already exists. Now, listen, we're going to hear both teaching methods effectively in use. It's an English lesson, which is your own subject, and it's at Tarpley High School in Cheshire.
OK, Year 9, thank you.
I'm Tara Stych, and I'm about to teach a class of Year 9 students who are aged about 13 years old. Today we're going to be looking at an Anne Frank diary entry. They've been asked for their homework to research Anne Frank, and we'll be testing their knowledge on that before they then go on to some short analysis of it before they create their own diary entries.
OK, are we ready? Where was Anne Frank born?
This lesson has probably slightly more skills-based focus, as that's quite important in our subject. However, they need to have that background of facts in the first place, and we'll be using that to think about what they would expect to find in the article, which I think is important.
OK, so one of the things that you've highlighted and why? Yes, Anna?
When ideals are being shattered and destroyed, because she always thought that people were good, but what she's finding out is that people are trying to hurt her and the people that she knows.
Yeah, the sort of a dawning realisation almost. And you could think about putting that into your writing as well, that perhaps you start with a sense of hope and then as time goes on, you become more and more disillusioned. Good.
Patrick? We're much too young to deal with these problems, I think, signifies that she's having to act too mature for her age just to survive in the annex.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Daisy and I'm 13.
I'm Reuben and I'm 13.
I'm Annabelle and I'm 13.
I'm Thomas and I'm 13.
Okay, so today's lesson was in part facts-based learning, where you're learning something new. Other parts of the lesson were putting skills into practice and doing something. Which do you think was most useful?
Probably today in that lesson, the fact-based learning, because it highlighted things I didn't already know. And the skills-based learning was just going over things, which helps you make best progress. But if you learn new things, then it also helps you make maybe quicker progress.
I think skills-based learning for me, because it helps me with things I don't know yet, and it teaches me new ways to make my writing better.
Probably the facts-based, because it meant that we could use the facts that we got told in our writing to make it better.
I enjoyed learning about the facts and what happened to her and why it happened.
And finally, I want you to think about which did you gain the most enjoyment from?
I enjoyed the facts because it meant that you could sort of picture yourself in her position, how hard it was for her to live.
It's got to be facts, definitely, because I really enjoy learning new things that I've never heard of before and that will help me.
I enjoyed aspects of both today, but I did enjoy the facts a lot because it's learning something new. That's always great.
Well, I guess if it's just facts, it doesn't really class as an English lesson because it's got to have a sort of bit of creative, technical sort of writing to be an English lesson?
I think we all enjoy the facts most because it's the easiest and we do the least work. But then when it does get down to actually doing the GCSEs and all that, you do need the skills so then you can get the higher grades that you'd want.
Daisy Christodoulou, I mean, they found the facts there, which you are saying actually should be encouraged more. They found that easier because I suppose it's more obvious. They know if they're getting it right, they know if they're getting it wrong.
I was delighted by how many of them did enjoy the fact-based part of the lesson. And I was also delighted when they said they enjoy learning new things. I think that is one of the lovely things about when you introduce pupils to new things that they've never seen or heard before. And certainly I can remember the things that I was taught for the first time by some of my teachers. Whenever I hear those things again in later life, it almost brings with it the memory of when you first heard them. So I think there is something very lovely about that. However, I would also have to say that I felt the division between facts and skills there was ever so slightly artificial and was probably not one that I would go along with. And in actual fact, what we think of as a skill, we often think of it as being transferable as well and something that can apply across the board. That actually, skills are very much domain specific and they depend on a body of facts in that particular area. So the idea of a skill as being this generic thing that transfers from one place to the other is not actually really backed up very well in the research. So I can see what you were doing in that clip, setting up the two different types of learning, but I'm not sure I sort of totally buy into it in that sense. I don't think it is a pendulum.
But this is exactly what, in a way, you have been accused of. And the reaction to your book was that you are setting up a false dichotomy. Brian Lightman, who's General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, he said it's that either-or mentality again, knowledge or skills, academic or vocational or fashioned or progressive. And most teachers say they use both.
I have been accused of it. I think there is a false dichotomy between facts and skills. And I think the false dichotomy are that people think you can just teach skills directly and you can bypass the facts. And I give plenty of examples in my book of that happening,
but
of
have
the
you
facts
ever...
being bypassed.
OK, so you have come across examples of teachers bypassing facts.
Yeah, and also the other problem, I think, as well, is this conception of skill, that we do have this conception of skill as being something that is generic, that applies across the board, and you get this idea that there are things you can do that can develop analysis or creativity, if you like, in a vacuum. And as I say, all the research doesn't show that. So I think the problem here is in a way, it almost is this word skill, that we have a false idea of what skill is, that we think it is something that can operate on its own and that it can be sort of achieved directly.
I asked you about whether we are going forward to teaching more facts, partly because I wonder how long we have been getting it wrong. How long do you think we have been getting it wrong in schools? Are we talking about just one generation, or are you suggesting we've got it wrong for a long time?
I think it's always hard to trace the precise practical impact of these ideas. They do go back to the Romantic era. In the 1930s in Britain, there was the Haddow Report into primary education. The 1930s is not an era that people would traditionally associate, if you like, with this kind of education. But in the Haddow Report, you can definitely see that point of view.
So we're talking about something that's decades old.
Absolutely.
So you really are not harking back to a golden age. You're saying we need a new, something far more radical, therefore.
I would absolutely say that is absolutely the case. And I'd also, the thing I stress as much as possible is, actually, the evidence I'm basing this on is really very recent and very cutting edge.
So in terms of the amount of facts that you can, I'm tempted to use the word drill, but I don't think you're going to like it, but that you can teach a child in order that they can use them, we're talking considerable amount of class time and quantity of information.
Absolutely. And all learning is about a change in long-term memory. And in fact, one of the scientists who works on this has defined learning as a change in long-term memory. And he says, if nothing has changed in long-term memory, nothing has been learned. So my question would be, if nothing is changing in long-term memory, what is happening? Are pupils learning?
You've come up with these seven myths about education. When you put them forward, facts prevent understanding, teacher-led instruction is passive, the 21st century changes everything, and you don't think it does? You don't think Google makes a difference?
No.
We should teach transferable skills. Your argument is they're not transferable. Projects are the best way to learn. You'd ditch projects.
I think that for novices, they don't help. I think that for pupils who have a sufficient amount of background knowledge already, then they can work.
But one of the arguments for projects is that you are crossing subject boundaries, that you are enabling a child, a student, to see the world as it is.
Absolutely. That's one of the very persuasive arguments from them. They're real world, they're authentic. And what I would say in response to that is that learning from the real world is exceptionally hard. Newton might have discovered a lot from watching an apple fall, and Archimedes might have discovered a lot from jumping in a bath, but most people don't. The real world is confusing. It can lead you down blind alleys. You don't get a lot of guidance in the real world. And that's why learning from the real world is so difficult. Instead, I think we should, as Newton said, we need to stand on the shoulders of giants. And having guidance to help you avoid some of the obvious pitfalls and obvious traps is far more efficient and leads to better learning.
Well, which the final myth, teaching knowledge is indoctrination. There is always, if you are selecting for a curriculum, your own biases, your own prejudices are in there, whether it's a government or a teacher.
You're absolutely right to point that out. It's a serious question. And I'd also say that's the reason why I think, you know, selection of what is in a curriculum, it should be debated, it should be discussed. It's not as if there's an alternative. And that's why I think, again, the skills agenda has been quite seductive. The idea that it's possible to short-circuit the facts and just teach the skills. And if that were possible, then maybe it would get us round some of these awkward decisions. But unfortunately, I think those decisions are with us. And as a society and as teachers and individuals, we have to make them the best we can. What I'd also say is, while some of these decisions are difficult, not all of them are as difficult as we sometimes think. So, for example, I think there is this bedrock of knowledge, this core of knowledge, which does help you to be able to understand the world. So, for example, if you look at certain ways people have come up with determining what that body of knowledge might be, in America, and I know of nothing similar that's been done in this country, but in America, researchers there undertook an analysis of the New York Times, and they looked at the kind of background knowledge you would need in order to understand an issue of the New York Times. And it turned out to be lots of quite basic, quite fundamental, historical, geographical, literary knowledge that you couldn't actually read the New York Times and understand it without that.
This is the thinking, the idea of cultural literacy, the thinking of Professor E.D. Hirsch, who's had a profound effect on you. He noted it, a couple of decades ago, when he was lecturing at a community college, and he noted that those kids from poorer backgrounds tended to be from black families who were bright and articulate in some subjects, really struggled when they were meant to be reading about the Civil War. And he thought it was just that there was a basic... It wasn't that they couldn't read, it wasn't that they didn't understand the words. It was a basic knowledge of facts that they were missing.
That's absolutely right. And Hirsch, obviously his book's called Cultural Literacy, and that term is one that has been used a lot in association with his work. And all this comes about because our working memories are so limited. And we don't have very much space in our working memories. Even, you know, people with very large working memories, it's limited. And actually, we rely very, very much on what we have stored in long-term memory to make sense of the world, to read, to understand what's around us.
And the argument is what? That if you are missing those basic facts, that cultural literacy, you are excluded. You will never advance.
It isn't even just basic facts. It's vocabulary. It's concepts and understanding about the world. I think one of the statistics that Hirsch cites is that you need to understand 95% of words in a text to understand the text. And anyone who's ever given a pupil a dictionary to look up a word and see them baffled by the dictionary definition will understand what I'm talking about.
Given your background, are you the kind of child that could have been left behind because of lack of cultural literacy?
I suppose my father, his parents were immigrants from Cyprus, and his mother was from Italy. And he always used to say to me that there were times when he was growing up where there were conversations he felt he couldn't join in with, where there were references being thrown about that he didn't understand, and he couldn't go home and ask his parents what they meant because they didn't know either.
Because they didn't speak English?
Well, his mother did. His father spoke quite poor English and maybe didn't have as much understanding of this country as people have lived here for generations. So he was always sure that he didn't want me to have that experience. So he was always trying to tell me about the world and to inform me about the world and to make sure that, you know, if I walked into a room, there wouldn't be a reference that I didn't understand.
And when you were young, your parents had, a market stall in Petticoat Lane?
Yeah, that's right, yeah, in Middlesex Street in London and various other street markets.
And you enjoyed it?
Yeah, it was great.
What, you used to help them when you were very young?
I did. I was there behind the stall.
OK. And home was what? I've read it described as a rundown housing estate in Stepney Green.
Yeah, that's right. It's now been demolished. It had a lot of problems, I think, with asbestos and all sorts. It was a 1960 tower block. So, yeah, I grew up there. Well, we were on the ninth floor when I was very young, but we got moved to the first floor. So I wasn't right up on the top of a tower block.
And then you won scholarship to a free place at what is a private school, City of London School for Girls.
It was the old assisted places scheme. I think I was one of the last years to get on it. It was abolished by the Labour government shortly after I got mine.
So it was as a result of your brain, your ability. How did your family react?
Yeah, well, they were obviously very happy for me. They were really pleased. I'll be honest, you know, I think my mother wanted me to go then. She was sort of the driving force behind it, you know, getting the forms, filling everything in. And my father said, no, don't send her to a private school. She'll turn into a stuck-up, toffee-nosed so-and-so. But, you know, I think my mother overruled him, so...
and he came round, obviously.
Well, yeah, I think he's come round in the end.
And for you, going there, I mean, it was a private school. There's a big difference between private and state schools. Probably more then than now. What was it like for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, obviously, back then you did have an assisted places scheme with X percent of the year were on assisted places. So I think there were about 18 out of a cohort of 90-odd. So there were other people from similar backgrounds too. But yeah, I mean, it was different, definitely. But kids get along, don't they? That's one of the things you realise as well. You sort of rub along in your background. It doesn't matter so much. But I was lucky to go there and I've made lots of good friends.
And you went on to university?
That's right. So Warwick University.
And actually, where a large part of the country saw you because you appeared on University Challenge and did rather well.
Yes, that's right. In my final year at Warwick, I was a captain of the team and we won for the first time in Warwick's history.
And in large part down to you?
No, I don't think that is true. It's a team game.
But it's certainly the case the papers loved you for it, didn't you? Because you had a remarkable run. You were able to answer a lot of questions. And what the papers had you is this the brainiest kid in Britain?
There was a headline that came up with that, which some of my pupils in later years then discovered and had a lot of fun with. So,
did they give you a hard time?
No. I think when they discovered it, they were highly entertained.
As if it were a serious business of the understanding.
Warren Christodoulou.
Poetry?
Poetry's correct. Your first bonus is Warwick are on country houses. The official residence of Chequers and the mansions of Stowe, Clifton and Taplow Court are situated in which English county?
Buckinghamshire.
Correct. Claydon House, north of Aylesbury, is noted for an interior in which style, uncommon in Britain because of its association with the extravagance of the Catholic French court?
Rococo.
Correct. Which country house in North Buckinghamshire was a centre for the government code and cipher school during World War II?
Bletchley Park.
Correct.
Was your success down to your education? What you learnt at school and the way you learnt it?
Well, I remember talking to a friend, actually, after I'd been on it, and she said we were in all the same classes at school, and I know I wouldn't have answered those questions. So I think if I've got to be fair, I can't say, you know, I don't think it was about what I learned on, if you like, on the syllabus or on the curriculum. But obviously, I owe a debt to my education and I learned lots there. And not just what I learned, but what it encouraged me to go on and learn.
OK. And it rather obviously depends on you knowing a lot of facts.
Well, that is true, yeah.
But it will lead some to say, look, you end up with what is a pub quiz curriculum. If you follow the argument, you're good at answering questions like on University Challenge, perhaps risking the wrath of Jeremy Paxman. Yeah. But how good is it more widely?
I think, you know, University Challenge is a bit of fun. I wouldn't suggest that it's the basis for a school curriculum, not by any means. It comes back to what I was saying before about, you know, what is learning? What is it to learn something? It's that change in long-term memory. So whatever you're doing, whatever it is you want to be successful in, whatever the area you want to achieve expertise, there is this underlying sort of body of facts and a practice that needs to be mastered. You can see it with chess players. There's certain things they have to know, and there's patterns and there's moves they have, and there's lots of practice they have to put in.
OK, and when you're looking across the school curriculum, do you think, and I know you did a lot of football, you did running, you love cricket, the importance of extracurricular, that is important to the rest of learning, is it?
I would say definitely. And it's not just important to the rest of learning, it's just important, you know, if you want to be cheesy, it's important for the good life. Obviously, I think learning is very important. That's why I went into education. But of course, it isn't everything. And yeah, I'm a huge sports fan. And I think sports and other extracurricular activities should have a huge role.
But somebody like Sir Ken Robinson, who's famous for his talks on creativity in schools, he said that schools should treat dance as seriously as they treat maths. Is he right?
I think that dance is important. And I think that it should play a role in the curriculum. Particularly if you look at maths and you look at language, the power they have and the way they're used in so many ways across our society, and you're just fundamental to be able to be a citizen, to be able to function in the economy, they are just absolutely vital. And likewise, look, I'm a huge cricket fan. I like cricket a lot more than I like maths, but I wouldn't make cricket compulsory and I would have maths as being compulsory.
You are remarkably young. You're not even 30. You wrote this book, started putting the ideas together a few years ago. The response has been phenomenal, both for good and bad. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it is such a potent idea, what you have proposed?
Well, I suppose I am saying that a lot of what happens at the moment is not based on good evidence. So, you know, that is obviously going to be controversial. And people who have been promoting those ideas are obviously, you know, not going to take it lying down, if you like, and they haven't. So I think that's obviously been one part of it. I think what's also interesting is it's not just me, you know, it's coincided with lots of other very interesting things happening in education. So if you look at a lot of the theories about practice and long-term memory and the importance of remembering and retrieval practice, you know, a lot of that, for example, has been publicised in very popular books like by Malcolm Gladwell. Mm-hmm. You know, that's been very popular. So I think you know, in a sense, I've been lucky. It's come out at a time when a lot of these ideas are swirling around and people want to know more about them. And I think my book has probably caught on to that tide a little bit.
But a lot of people would say, look, you didn't teach long enough to know. You only had, just a few years before you came up with these ideas. What can you have known? You have had, you know, the people would say you need to teach for years before you get anywhere near understanding what's going on in a classroom.
I can leave that to the readers to judge. Obviously, the book is partly drawn on my own experiences, but actually I tried very much not to base it on my own experiences because I knew that if I did that, people would say, well, it's anecdotal, and again, you haven't been teaching for very long. So I have tried as much as possible to draw evidence from sources beyond my own experiences.
And what you've done since is work for academies and
That's
work
right.
on curriculum, the sort of things that are taught in schools. Mm-hmm. If you want to change things, is that how you go about it, by just changing effectively one school at a time, by getting teachers to change the way that they teach? Or does the current system not allow that? Would Ofsted prevent people effectively from doing what you say is necessary?
I think that change in education of the type that I'm talking about can't be brought about from the top down. I think it's a bottom-up process. I don't think there's not a lever that any government can pull that will say, you know, you must teach like this at 11:33 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. So in order for the ideas I'm talking about to have an impact, people have to believe them, to be convinced that they're right, and to put them into practice in their own classroom. And I don't think that's going to happen through a government edict.
But are they going to be prevented by schools' inspections? Because what they like to see is the examples you used in your book.
I think that is an issue. I still think there is a sort of an issue with Ofsted and indeed with the wider framework of organisations around education. So I think that certainly still is an issue. But I think that outstanding schools and outstanding teachers will be able to overcome what I think is a prejudice against some of these lessons.
And those that say this is actually about ideology, that mm-hmm. you've picked up on mm-hmm. ideas that came from the States, mm-hmm. just as the former Education Secretary mm-hmm. Michael Gove has their right-wing mm-hmm. ideas, and they don't have a place in schools.
I absolutely don't think they're right-wing, and I think that most of what I'm advocating really is that we should have a better understanding of the scientific research about how we learn. I absolutely don't think that it's right-wing. It's interesting, there's a very strong and very proud sort of left-wing tradition of saying that working class children should be exposed to the best that has been known and fought. And I would say that all the great breakthroughs that have been made by people across the world from all kinds of different cultures, they belong to everyone. And to say that they're somehow elitist or right-wing or upper class is absurd. They're part of our common inheritance.
And what if we don't change? What if it carries on being, as you claim it is, far too biased towards skills rather than facts?
I think that it will be the situation where wealthier pupils, people from more advantaged backgrounds, pupils who get that exposure to cultural literacy, if you like, that you get that from home, that they'll get that. And pupils who don't have ways of getting that won't. So you'll entrench social divisions. That would be what I think would happen.
So what you're talking about is a wholesale change to the way we teach.
I think what I'm most interested in is bottom-up changes. So what I want to happen the most is for teachers to engage with the evidence that's out there and to be presented with a real selection of all the evidence that's out there, not just what I think a very heavily biased version. And if that happens, I'll be happy. And I think if teachers are presented with that selection, I think they'll make the right decisions. As John Milton said, let truth and falsehood grapple. Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a free and fair encounter. So if the truth is out there, I've got no doubts that it'll win.
Daisy Christodoulou, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.